from NPR Music. You're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. I'm here with Robin Hilton. On this edition of All Songs Considered, Robin and I have a conversation with Beck. A lot's happened since Beck released his last full-length studio album about 5.5 years ago. He's suffered and since recovered from a back injury that made it difficult for him to even hold a guitar. He recorded a new album, shelved the whole thing, and launched several other projects online, including an art gallery, mixtapes of his favorite songs, and Record Club, a series of cover albums performed by Beck and his friends. There was also 2012's Song Reader, an album's worth of new songs Beck released as sheet music for others to perform and record. Morning Phase is Beck's new record, and it comes out February 25th. The album has more in common with Sea Change than any other Beck record. It's a slow, introspective journey, and the making of the record has had its own journey, lots of stops and starts.
Some of these songs have been around for a bit. I tried to make this record a few times. I went to Nashville a few years ago, and I was going to make a Nashville record. I've done that a couple of times.
Was this the thing with Jack White?
Well, when I was there, I did that 7-inch, yeah.
I see.
And but I did a lot of recording there, and I think it was okay. It just didn't. It was one of those things where it just didn't quite come together. And then when I started working on this record, I took a few of those songs and we kind of redid them. And so that's really the beginning of the record, is going to Nashville. But something about bringing it back here, and I got the band that I did most of Sea Change with. I got all of them together, and then it just felt like felt right, you know. The song started to work and it started to feel like a record.
What happens to you when something feels right? I mean, I know that's maybe a bit of an intangible.
I think what happens is you just stop sleeping. You stop. like making the record. Uh-oh. I just felt like, okay, it's happening now. Like, so you just hold on. And so I spent about 5 months in the studio pretty much around the clock, and the record was supposed to come out last year, so we were on this deadline trying to get it done, and then it ended up getting pushed back. So
pushed back because of things that you did or didn't do, or just pushed back because of business?
Well, we kind of got to the end and it was done, and then we didn't have a record label, so that was a small technical thing. I mean.
Did you ever entertain the idea of just putting it out yourself?
I did, yeah. I've been talking about that for years.
This new record,
yeah,
comes out on Capitol.
I think it comes down to the people that I work with and management. That's a lot of extra work for everybody. So it's easier to go somewhere where that's what they're doing night and day. And I had some friends, people that I worked with for a long time at Capitol, so I ended up there. And well, I think back to what I was saying before about the record. I think having that deadline, it being an intensive thing, I think it helped ultimately kind of make the whole thing feel cohesive and
thematic. I mean, I'm going to play a little bit of just the opening. For the people out there who have not heard any of this record, you listen to this little piece called Cycle, which is this 40-some-odd second song, and the tone for this 45 minutes is completely set by this. I mean, it's kind of very programmatic. I mean, it feels like dawn in quite that literal interpretation that happens between something that's not very literal, music, and something that we see and feel in every day. Do you feel that way about that piece? Do you think it feels like morning to you? It certainly.
Yeah, I didn't intend it. When we were in the studio, we were doing all the strings. We actually did them at Capitol. So it was
in Los Angeles?
Yeah. And they have these studios down in the basement of that famous Capitol building where Frank Sinatra and all these classic records were made. We were just creating some fragments because I always have extra pieces. I think when you hear a final record, like a record like this, you hear about 20% of the actual music that was made. And so there's so many little pieces, and I think at the last minute I have one of these fragments, and I had about 4 or 5 of them, and I just tried sticking them in different places. So it wasn't really thought out. It was kind of a something, a piece that just fell into place. It's like, oh, that works. A lot of times it doesn't.
Yeah,
you throw pieces around
80% of the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, most of the time it doesn't.
You mentioned the lyrical process and how some people are hearing these sort of California, the Pacific Ocean kind of themes in the music, and that it wasn't necessarily intentional. Do you find that you approach this music, you really didn't have any agenda, and you more discover the songs?
Yeah, I had that song Wave. That's something I recorded about 5 years ago, and I tried to give it to a few other people. So I just had that song sitting around for a long time, and I played it for people, and I always had this, got this reaction. And so I started to put together songs that felt like they could go with that song and build around that. So that was kind of, that was always the center of the record. And then I had some of these Nashville songs to add a little bit of lightness. And the record's pretty slow. I think at one point we realized it was nothing faster than 60 BPMs. Well, which
it's half
beats
a dance
per minute,
yeah, right.
That's really slow.
Your average dance song is 120, so yeah. This is.
Yeah, I think a hit song has to be 120 something.
So BPM, someone is going to double speed your record. You know that.
I hope so.
You could have a hit on your hands.
I've actually was told that if I just put a beat here.
Can I play Wave for folks that haven't heard it and come back and talk about some stuff you hinted at, which is the orchestration, how that evolves. That happen in your head? Do you do it? You write it? Do you do it with other people? Let me play a little bit of this, though.
I'm miles away from this place, in the form of a disturbance, and enter into the world like some
There's a fellow there named David Richard Campbell, you know rather well, who worked on the strings.
Yeah.
How do you work together?
Yeah.
Your dad?
Well, I mean, each song's different. That one in particular, I had the song written, and then I usually get some kind of keyboard, and I'll play the basic voicings, and we'll
can I be really geeky
map
specific? When you say written, how are we talking here? Are we talking about on score, on paper? Are we talking about in your head?
You know, it used to always be in my head, and then there was a certain point where I had to put them on tapes so I could remember them.
Mm-hmm. Age?
Voicemail. I'll put them on a computer or whatever is handy, and then bring the basic form and structure. And with strings, a lot of times I'll play or sing parts over it that will transcribe. That's actually what happens a lot. It's a song called on Sea Change called Paper Tiger, and there's a whole solo that the orchestra does. And that was actually something I sang, and then we just transcribed it.
Oh, cool. And the transcription, when you say this, are you talking your dad would transcribe it in that case?
Yeah, and there's also other people he works with.
And then in this case, so you brought this in some form of recording, and then how did the orchestration come to be?
It's funny listening to it. The vocal got so loud.
Mm-hmm.
Like after mixing and mastering, the vocal was always tucked in this sort of huge orchestra. So the vocals are...
You actually sound like God.
Yeah, it's supposed to be tucked in there, but I don't know.
It had a lot of power. I'm just going to say, I listened to it this morning. It was pretty good.
That was a tricky one because you don't want to get in the way of the orchestra at the same time. You know, you want to... Actually, a lot of these songs on this record, it was like, how do you keep this mood and then not sing on it and disrupt it or break the spell of whatever's happening with the music? Really tricky on a lot of these songs.
So you approach that a couple of different ways. I mean, in this case, your voice is very big.
Yeah. Well, not intentionally, but yeah, and some of them, it's singing soft, singing higher, trying different voices. Mm-hmm. I had songs where I'd try singing it 20 different ways. I mean, just beating it into the ground. And then you finally find something, okay, this feels like it's part of the song. And I've heard other singers who are more, you know, proper trained singers. They have certain voices that they'll just use. They just know that works. Mm-hmm. Whereas I kind of have to feel my way through it a bit.
But you're not untrained. I mean, you have this in you.
Believe me, I'm really untrained. I need some training.
Fool me.
I'm making it up as I go, really.
It must be a constant voice in your head. I just think of you as being so prolific. And I was joking with Bob before doing this interview. I was just scrolling through my library and thinking, has this guy written a bad song? I've got like 200 songs. 200
yeah,
songs
there's
here.
There's some bad ones.
And then
yeah,
I thought...
For sure. You have to write the bad ones, you know.
There you go.
To get to a decent one. You really do. I really believe in that. I kind of wish there was more room for people to make bad records and just make a couple of bad ones, you know, to get to the good stuff. It's part of the process.
Do you still do that now? Do you still find that throw it away and start over?
Yeah, a lot.
So how do you get past that voice that tells you, wow, this one's crap? You know,
it's hard. I think I had a lot of years that was really hard. And I was talking to a friend about this a while ago, sort of the rise of internet and all the blogs and the sort of internet criticism. I think it's affected a lot of musicians, this sort of this critical voice in their head. And I think we're all getting used to it now. I think there's something happening in the last few years. I might be just talking out of my neck, but I think there is something. It's like somebody's pointed a camera or a mirror at you, and a little more self-conscious. And I don't know. I feel like I've felt it in music over the last 10, 12 years.
Do you mean more introspective?
Or just a little bit more, if I do this, then it's going to be this or that.
Yeah.
You know, when I started out, I mean, you were just throwing stuff out there. You had no idea what people thought. I mean, there'd be a couple of record reviews, but you really were completely ignorant of and unaware of what people actually thought, unless you were at a show. You know, you could play a song and people didn't like it. That happened plenty of times.
Has anything you've ever done made you want to just give up making music?
I've been encouraged to give it up many times.
Name names.
Well, you know, I had a really early experience. I lived in New York in the 80s, and there was a small folk scene, just probably the last gasp, the last strands of a village, East Village folk scene happening, you know, left over from the 60s and 70s. And I got to go play music for one of the members of the Weavers.
We're talking this morning, Pete Seeger passed away.
I didn't know that.
Oh my gosh.
Oh gosh.
Wow. Did that happen today?
Yeah.
Last night.
Oh wow.
94. So Pete Seeger, for those who don't know, at 94 years old, was a main figure in folk music and so much political movement and everything, but he was in the Weavers, right? And the Weavers were one of the few folk groups that sold records in the 50s. I mean, they put folk on the map in pop music. So anyway,
and a time that was not friendly to.
That's right, because of the politics.
What they were singing about. They popularized a lot of the folk music, and along with Woody Guthrie, probably planted the seeds for the folk revival,
right,
which leads to the singer-songwriter.
And Woody and Pete used to travel around the country together.
Yeah, exactly. And I was pretty steeped in all that as a kid. I read all those books and learned a lot of the songs, and you know, that's what I started out really drawn to. I got to play for one of the members of the Weavers, and I remember getting you ever thought of going back to school? You know, kind of. He said, look.
Don't give up your whatever day job you don't
have. Look, it's nice that you're doing this, but I really don't think it's a good idea for you to play music. I mean, I would not put, and I at the time, you know, I really didn't have ambitions or hopes. I was just doing it because, you know, I liked playing music, and I was drawn to folk music because it was something you could just kind of do. You didn't have to be trained or groomed, you know. Growing up in, you know, that particular period or coming of age in the 80s, the superstar acts, that the artists who were popular were kind of superhuman. It was like, how do you do that, you know?
Yeah.
You were how old then?
Probably 18, uh-huh. I think.
So what made you basically say to that person who said to you, you gotta go back to school, what made you say, I've got something?
Well, you know, again, I wasn't there for that. I was just there to meet him and to say hello. I wasn't there to, you know, get his permission to play music.
Yeah.
And, you know, for so many years, I played music with no encouragement I just did it for, you know, because the like-minded people were down at, you know, whatever bar, coffee house, you know, whether it was the Chameleon or ABC No Rio in New York or Al's Bar or Raji's in L.A. And, you know, that's where people were hanging out. And it was also a way to get into the shows free, by the way, which was good for me. It was
Who do you remember seeing back then that really touched your soul?
Well, I got to New York right when Daniel Johnston had been there.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know who he was yet. This is mid-80s.
Help people, because not everybody knows the wonderful Daniel.
Yeah, and he had put out all these cassette tapes, but I wasn't aware of those. So we'd be just trading songs with different people, and I learned a couple of his songs. I thought they were old folk songs. So I had been performing them for a while, and then finally somebody told me, no, that's a Daniel Johnston song. You know, he's one of these self-made, you know, songwriters who was recording on a little cassette deck at his parents' house and making his own albums. And
one of a kind.
One of a kind,
we'll say,
yeah.
We'll say, for sure.
But these great songs, almost like lost classics, they could have come from the sort of great songbook of songs. And so things like that were happening when I was there. But I still got to see a lot of, whether it was John Spencer or the Melvins or Nirvana or, you know, whatever was happening at that time. I was kind of more drawn to the folk stuff, though. I used to go see Dave Van Ronk and Ramblin' Jack Elliott. And there was a place in L.A. called Babe and Ricky's. It was an old blues bar down on Central. I had a fake ID, so I used to get in there. And a lot of good music there.
We saw you up in Newport this summer.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
That was a good night. Did you get out to any of the clubs? Because that's, like, there the whole bunch of clubs in Newport that have a nice feeling, and a lot of the musicians from Newport go hang out and stuff.
I'd always wanted to do that, you know, when I heard they were doing.
Yeah.
For people who haven't been there, it's an amazing location. It's actually hard to play, because what you're looking at is just so grand.
I love to think of the connections to folk in your music. I certainly you listen to an early record like One Foot in the Grave, but I think it's a spine that is always present, connecting all the records together, even up into Morning Phase.
Yeah, it's something that I've had a lot of trouble reconciling, these diverging musical directions. I think if I was a band, you know, one thing would be called this, and then those records might be called something else, but so I haven't really figured my way around it. I thought for a while of calling these kind of records something else, just to differentiate from things like Odelay.
Do you think of it as folk music, though? I mean, is that what you're...
The music that I play?
Yeah. I mean, would you think that maybe somebody would see you in a small cafe singing these songs?
It's such a strange term now.
That's
folk
right.
Music,
yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
But the singer-songwriter thing is a hard term, too.
Because the folk music is just kids making things on laptops at home, you know.
That's right.
With some software they downloaded for free, you know.
Exactly. Which gets shared
same,
as much as,
it's
right.
It's the same impulse. So, yeah, but music made on acoustic instruments and, yeah, I mean, that'll never go away.
You want to play something, Robin?
Well, we're going to premiere the song Waking Light from the new record. Is there anything you want to tell us about it before we hear a little bit of it?
This is one of the songs from Nashville, actually.
Closes out the record.
Yeah, it ended up being at the end of the record. I had it at the beginning before. And it's one of those where I started this sort of theme, this morning theme was kind of revealing itself in the record and a few of the songs, and that song kind of tied it together.
Waking light, your profile in shadow. Raise yourself to the morning alone. Night is gone, long way turning. You've waited long. Somewhere you can't make it whole. such a life to go. How much can you show? Dave is gone on a landslide of ribbon. I've seen your lamplight burning low. When the man rest your eyes in waking
tell us about the players. Tell about who's on this record and who are your buddies.
I'm playing piano kind of badly. And then
you are hard on
these
yourself.
Keyboards.
Well, you know, you're actually quite good at this. You've got this music thing figured out.
If you saw the musicians I play with, though, I mean, they're scary. They're uh-huh. so good.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Who's on this?
The Glockenspiel there. Who's playing that?
That's me.
Yeah?
I make a lot of the weird ambient sounds. There was a lot more on this song originally, and then when Tom Elmhurst mixed it, he took a lot of that stuff out or just kind of tucked it way in. Mm-hmm. There was much more going on in general on this record, so I think he's responsible for simplifying and kind of giving it more space.
How about drums?
Which I think really helps. That's Joey Warnker, who's... I've been playing with him since before my first record came out.
Wow.
We've been playing together for 22 years or 21 years or Amazing. Something like that.
You mentioned this space and it breathes. That's something I always love about percussion on your records, but particularly here is that they're really full fills, but they breathe. It's not like you're cramming too much in.
That was a bit of a trick. You know, how do we give this space and let it breathe, but then it's not boring, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of balance there was a lot of kind of trying to find a balance on this record.
You had a couple of different bass players on this record too.
Yeah, that's true. That song had tracked in Nashville, and then we ended up, there was something wrong with some of the recordings, so we had to redo the drums, and then the bass didn't really fit, so then we got someone else. And then it was just kind of whoever's available. Everyone's so busy these days, so it was kind of whoever we could get. And
so this one's credited to Justin Melville.
Right, Justin played on that. Yeah,
he's
played with me for probably 20 years, and we knew each other as kids.
I saw Stanley Clark's name on this.
Yeah, while we were working on the record, I went down to see him and Chick Corea play acoustic one night at the jazz club.
Stanley Clark, a great bass player, for those who don't know from Return to Forever, would be one.
Yeah, and his solo records. I mean,
killer.
I don't know if you've seen some of the album covers for the solo records, too, are some of my favorites.
Yeah.
And he had like a whole Prince period, which is really interesting.
Seemed like an odd match, although, he seemed like an odd match.
I don't know if you've seen those acoustic shows, but it's just, I recommend it, like even if you're not a fan of jazz, or it's sort of jaw-dropping.
Huh.
I would see that. It's like, okay, this is another category of musician.
He used to play with that other Beck guy, the Jeff Beck guy, Mr. Stanley Clark did, yeah.
That's right. But he's, one of these, as a musician, a monster,
Mm-hmm.
But also, he really thinks about what he plays and...
I want to go backwards. I'm going to play what is basically the opening song on the record. We play the opening swell strings, the little piece that you've placed at the top. And I want to play Morning, well, for many reasons, but let's just play a little bit. Was that staring and out of the ocean I was talking about earlier really hit me on strong on this song. There is a lot of the words in this record seem to have things that, why don't you show me the way it used to be, and there's a lot of the you in these songs, and I don't know if it's the same you in these songs or who the you is.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's general, because I think on that song it can be pretty much anybody, because you never know where you're going to get that kind of guidance or something's going to be revealed, For me, it can be from my kids, it can be from a friend, mm-hmm. conversation, hearing an interview on the radio.
Like this.
Exactly.
I just think of your lyrics.
I don't know if people are going to get that from this. What I'm saying.
Oh, life-changing.
I think of your lyrics so often as being a little cryptic, especially if you mentioned Odelay on a record like that, for example, whereas this feels much more inward-looking, perhaps more intimate. Do you have a preference? Yeah. Is one easier than the other, or do you have one that you're more comfortable with?
This kind of song is harder, I think, in that there's certain genres, certain kind of songs that are well... trodden, they're pretty well mapped out, so when you're going there, it's like there's an aspect of like, okay, I've heard this before, you know.
Right.
So doing something that's gives it a reason to exist. So I think at that point, I just try to find something that just really, really simple at the center of what the feeling of the song is trying to say. And for me, that song, I get a little choked up, like, because when we played that song, it was actually the first time me and the musicians had been in the room together since we did Sea Change, which I think, you know, was 12 years ago or something.
Yeah.
So it was the first time we'd all been in the room recording together and in that same room. And
wow.
And I had these injuries for years and years, and a certain guitar, it was really hard for me to play.
It was more and back.
So this is the first time I could play the guitar again in probably 7-8 years. And so that song, that's something I just came up with while we were playing. I just started playing those chords and then we ran through it. So to me, that song is just, for me, the sound of we're all here again and we're able to do this again. And
it must have been, you know, such a release for you after.
Yeah, it was a release, and also being with them. We've all at that point have had kids and married and divorced and lost parents and, you know, all these things. So just sit there all together looking at each other, and it was
beautiful.
What a beautiful moment.
Yeah, it was powerful for me, and also being in that room and where we made so much music. I mean, it's not like we did this 40 years ago, but it was funny. Michel Gondry, I was going to do a video with him at some point, and the idea was from when he'd seen a documentary of the musicians who worked at Stax, and there was a shot of them there at the site, and the building had, I think, been torn down. He thought of doing a video where we're all older recording at this studio that we recorded at when we were younger, and that he was going to do some process where suddenly we were young again and the building came back together. I wish we'd had the money to do this video.
That's awesome.
But I kind of thought of that after we were recording there. It was kind of like, oh, this is kind of revisiting something. Although it's not a great amount of time that's gone by. But
a dozen years is something. Yeah, no,
can change.
Yeah, I mean, think of what happens to a child from birth to 12. I mean, this is a sensational amount of stuff happens.
That song, Morning, it feels like it has such a kinship with All Things Must Pass, the George Harrison song, both in the feel and I think themes, too.
Yeah, I have to listen to that again. There's something that happens when you slow down a song like that, too. We're always, when I'm recording with my band, we're always egging each other on to play it slower and slower. Because for one thing, it's really difficult to play that slow and stay in time for it to still feel musical.
Yeah.
But it also does something really kind of, it warps the perspective of the song. Like if that song was even a bit faster, it'd be a completely different song.
Yeah. Hard, especially live.
We've played some of these songs and some of the Sea Change songs live, and it's, I've played with musicians who can't actually do it. It's it's a weird one. It's really weird.
You've spent an awful lot of time in the last bunch of years remaking records of people who you love, and I just wonder how that informs making, let's say, a song like this, a song like Morning, or any of the songs that you do. Once you start to dig in and learn about how other people do what they do, because you get so inside of it.
Yeah, you know, the original intention was just to get musicians together, and then I just need an idea to hang it on, you know.
Right.
Because I knew there wouldn't be enough time to really write music, but if there was a record we could cover, and that's just kind of playtime for musicians, you know. So much of what we do is most bands, they, you know, they go out and they play a similar set every night, and there's kind of a routine, and there's a job aspect to it, and then to create kind of an autonomous space, you know, to just kind of go and make a bunch of noise, and it's something that I would just do with my friends when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And you get to a point where you're like, oh, I have to call 10 people and we have to get a budget just to play a gig, you know. So and after a lot of years, I finally realized we just have to create something where we can just go around and
but all those sorts of things where you start and you have this original idea for something, all those things always turn out to be something else, don't they? I mean, mm-hmm. Right? So for you, for that, what did it mean to do those things? What did it mean to do a Velvet Underground record or any of them?
Well, I think that aspect of it is important. I think you read about any musician who's done something important. There's a period where they've ingested some vast amount of music. You know, they've learned just hundreds and hundreds of songs. I think that's something that's important. Even something important to do after you've been putting out records for years. Just there's something about learning the song. That was that songbook that I put out last year. That's something I was thinking about with that book. There's something about learning or playing the song yourself that is different than listening.
Mm-hmm. I would think getting all those friends together like that and trying these different projects would be very renewing for you, a renewal of sorts, sort of reinvigorate you in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always looking for that. I'm always looking for some different way to do it or try something in a different... And just, it's all experimentation, really, you know?
Right,
and I never really know where it's going to lead, you know? Like, what is... You know, let's do this record club thing. And sometimes it does lead to something. I mean, I think some of the... We played with Wilco this summer. When we did one of the records together, I think there were a few ideas for the production of their next record, you know? So I think it's good. It's good to mix it up with other musicians and things rub off, you know? And you think to the periods of music where there were a lot of breakthroughs or, you know, things were really evolving. Those were periods where people were hanging out. They were coming down to the studio or down to the club playing together.
There you go. Yeah.
Whether it's like Stones, Beatles, Donovan, Clapton, Jimi Hendrix, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, on and on and on and on and on. They're all kind of there rubbing shoulders, and that I think that makes music better. And I noticed, I came up in a time where people were very separated. You know, you do these festivals for years of people, and you sort of, you know, see Tom York in the hallway going to the bathroom and kind of, you know, there's not a lot of, there's not always that same camaraderie or, you know.
I see that in Newport, kind of, but I don't go to a lot of festivals, but that's still a festival that happens where the musicians rub elbows, hang out.
Yeah, like when we were playing, Ramblin' Jack Elliott walked up
right
on stage.
That was wonderful.
I mean, that wasn't even planned. I used to save up my money to go see him play when I was a kid.
That's perfect. Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excuse my sleepiness.
What did you?
Early morning and a late night.
Should we go out on Blue Moon? Was the first song that you put out from Morning Phase? So.
Yeah, this one's weird because it's such an afterthought. It was a demo that I just did by myself.
And who names a song Blue Moon?
Well, I've been reading this Elvis book that I'd had on my shelf for like 15 years, and I finally read it about a couple of years ago. The Gralnick book. Did you read that?
I've read chunks of that book, but I've not read
the whole
book. It's
a tome. Yeah. But it's great. Going through the thing, I feel like every musician when they're starting out should just read that book. It's sort of a...
The lies you tried to hide behind your eyes is a line in your song. Is that is that Elvis influenced, or am I looking into something here that isn't there?
I was thinking about the Blue Moon thing because that song, I think, just encapsulates him at the beginning, this sort of purity, this kind of... And when you read the book, you really get a sense of who he was at the beginning. And then at the end, you see him go through the entire cycle of, for lack of a better term, show business. And where he's at the end in Vegas, ensconced in this hotel room, kind of remote and separated from the world and life. You know, you really get a sense in the book when he's younger, he's just so accessible. You know, he lived with his parents, and after dinner would go outside and sit with his fans who'd all be waiting outside. They were allowed to wait, and he would come out after dinner. And you know, and you see these photographs where he just on the train with the photographer, and then he just hopped off the train at one point. And so that song was kind of that's what I was thinking about with it, but it wasn't necessarily intended for the record. I just found it actually as we were finishing the record.
hey, can we come over and go through your vault?
No, I found it. It was just by chance. I'd forgotten about it completely, and then I sent it.
What do you mean you find it? I mean, what are we looking at now? Are we looking at, like, computer files? Are we looking at a room full of tapes? Computer files.
Both, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll be over soon.
Do you just lie in your sleep? I mean,
I could use your help.
Okay.
I'm sure.
All right. I've got August free. Thanks for this.
Yeah, thank you so much, and we'll go out on Blue Moon then.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Yeah, great record.
You too.
Cheers.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Lies that will divide us both in time.